Welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast where we really dig your fab gear. We're still in season three of Doctor Who, we're up to our final part. Thankfully, says Richard, who I think is never going to agree to host one of these again.
It is like 1 o'clock in the morning now. It's crazy.
Their time, yeah.
Yes, we really love these guys, these listeners.
Flies. We do. We love you. And the people who love you are Brendan.
Oh, and Nathan.
And Richard. Hello.
And we've just got three more stories to talk about. We have...
We've forgotten.
I've dried again.
What's the next one called?
We have the gunfighters. We have the pistoleurs. Les savageurs. And la machine de guerre.
That's it.
And we've just lost our only French listener. We have the gunfighters, the
savages,
and the war machines. Yeah. So, God, let's just get to it. Because it's your last chance.
So fill up your glasses and join in the song. The law's right behind you and it won't take long. So come
for the gunfighters.
Oh, hooray! Whoa.
Is this where we do actually all get to be Linda Barron?
No, we'll edit that in later.
I think Linda Barron is a part of all of us.
So this is actually my story, which is a bit of a shame because although I watch it over and over again, I haven't really got anything at all to say. No, that's not at all true. I've talked before, I think, about the gunfighters, and I think people already know what I'm going to say about it. I have a history of not liking the historical stories very much.
Hmm.
Is this the point at which I should go on a 15-minute rant about how much I hate the massacre? No, all right. But there are some stories that I really like.
And dead stare there, listener.
Essentially, the stories that I like are the Romans, the Mythmakers, and the Gunfighters. And I've said why before.
Donald Cotton.
Some Donald or Dennis or something. And it is to do with getting the Doctor and his friends and dumping them into a story, an existing story, with very strong tropes.
Yeah, well, this one's just all tropes, isn't it?
Swinging from the tropes.
Yeah, because, you know,
this is the Mythmakers again. This is where Prime and the old one realises his sons have got him into a war he shouldn't be getting into. This one could so easily have been Shane, Gunfight at the OK, High Noon, all those westerns. You know what? The Peter Hanning review, or the Jeremy Bentham review, the Peter Hanning. Nathan, you did a beautiful reading of this last time.
This is outrageous.
This wasn't. Can I just say? Can we guess that maybe this wasn't loved by the fans of the?
Look, it's been said a lot of times before that the Gunfighters had a really poor reputation among fandom. But then, when we had the opportunity to actually see it, and I don't know when it got a VHS release.
It was very late on. It came out as one of the final William Hartnell stories. There was a box set of three videotapes, and it was...
So it was the leftover No One Gives a Crap collection.
Well, almost. It was the Sensorites and the Gunfighters, but it was also the Time Meddler, because the print of the Time Meddler was so rough it took them ages to release it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But with the other two, it was these two stories are unloved.
Well, and I read Wife in Space talking about Gunfighters, and they were watching a VHS version, and Neil says that the DVD version was, you know, yet to be released, that they might watch it again. And so, you know, it's kind of unloved, and part of the reason it's unloved is because people didn't really get the chance to see it. And again, we've quoted this before. This is Peter Haining's book, Doctor Who A Celebration, published in 1983, and really the only source that any of us had at the time to know what this was about. And here's the final paragraph, and can you do
echo effect on.
It was not good, it was bad, and it was ugly. That's really all I'm doing.
I can hear that.
That's so terrible, isn't it? But the echo effect
said a lot more than that, didn't he?
Does make it sound like the voice of God. Oh, no, he just says, you know, the cereal is poor, it was Massacre of the OK Corral, you know, the British can't do westerns, blah, 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 blah. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is, this is an extraordinarily strong story, a really, really entertaining one right from the get-go.
It's very funny.
Yeah, exactly. It's really funny. Suddenly, In fact, he's completely wrong about the production. It looks amazing. Where are they shooting this? Like, that opening scene, you know, you're under a cart or something and there's a horse trough and the camera moves up and you get Linda Barron's song and it's a street and there's, like, shop fronts and stuff. It's this massive set that they're riding horses around. Yeah, yeah. So it looks spectacular.
You can certainly see why Rex Tucker was the caretaker producer, possibly the producer of Doctor Who before Verity Lambert came into the picture. And he sort of departed for various reasons, so this it becomes his only official involvement in the program. But you can see that he is a very competent director, both of the vision of the episode. There's lots of experimental shots. He shoots through mirrors to get certain shots in the bar. There's actually a panel in behind the bar that folds open so he can shoot a mirror so he can get a certain angle.
Right.
And, you know, he shoots the death of Charlie from a mirror suspended above so you can see him sprawled across really the bar.
Nice. And it's an awful scene, isn't it? Yeah. Like, that's a terrible shot.
But also, and I am going to say that Mr. Haining is right on one thing, in that the accents are of variable quality, but the actual performance...
Really, unlike Dodo's accent, yeah, well, you know, and she's actually from that country.
That was leading to a compliment. The performances, the actors' performances and intention
are good.
Are very good.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There is not a single character that I would point to and say, you're not giving this your all.
Yeah,
everyone, and you know, one of the lesser Clanton brothers decides, you know, I don't have very much to do, so I'm going to give my character a stutter, and it really elevates him and makes him a memorable character. So when he does get locked up later in the story, those scenes are actually interesting because
Warren. No, I can't keep the Clanton straight in my head.
No, not nigh. But
it's Ike and Phineas Clanton and Billy Clanton and
maybe it's Billy. Dad. Who's Warren? Warren is
Warren Earp is.
Oh, Warren
Earp.
You mean?
Well, there's Warren Earp. Oh, well, he's going to Warren who gets shot.
Yeah.
It is hard to keep track of all the characters. Because
they does stick to the history as far as we know. Well, there's divergent. That is important. There's divergent history. It is to me. Yeah.
And the fun thing, I think, too, is, like, we're having fun because we recognise the genre traditions. Tropes. So we're kind of having fun. But they're having fun as well. And so the moment, you know, they come out of the TARDIS, Dodo and Stephen rush back in. They realise where they are. They rush back in and they put on cowboy outfits and cowgirl outfits, but sort of preposterous,
ridiculous dress up.
Yeah. And in a sense, that actually works quite well because, by contrast, the cowboys, who are sort of slightly fake and not sort of massively convincing...
They all swap accents from one episode to another.
Yeah, kind of fun. That's sporting. But
it's like, oh, that's what Shane Rimmer's doing. I'll do that next week. Meanwhile, Shane Rimmer's going, oh, that's what William Handel's doing. I'll do that next week.
So it points up that they don't really belong in this world. They're not kind of fitted to it. And it makes the cowboys, who could have been slightly crummy, actually appear a bit more real and dangerous because they go into this world, they've got guns and they're sort of being silly and, you know, terribly excited and Stephen's wearing sort of satin and tassels and all sorts of stuff. So it is sort of, you know, he's camping it up. And what they don't realise is that they're in a situation where there's very real danger. And this is a world where guns... You know, we've talked about guns before, and it's going to come up again, but this whole thing ends in a giant gunfight. We promised it by the song, you know, very early on. This isn't the kind of world that they're sort of suited for. But the whole thing is sort of played for comic effect, and
it's played brilliantly. This is the first time since first season that Billy really gets into
He's really
Did you know
into
this was one of Hartnell's things. He wanted to do a cowboy, an Indian. And the thing we forget, just like Patrick McGoohan when he made The Prisoner a couple of years later, wanted to do a Western trope, I could believe is the word you used, in that it was a big thing, just as for us, I guess, post-Star Wars, sci-fi stuff is a big thing. It was for them. It was the go-to default.
Yeah.
external drama.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. No, no, I mean, it was huge. I mean, it was massive in Star Trek, this one, and all of that sort of thing. It was, but it's the thing that you go and see, you know, on you know, at the movies and that sort of thing. That's the action-adventure genre that people go to. Mm. So it is huge, and it is the first time the BBC ever attempted.
And they were a bit nervous about it, because, you know, the bar was set by John Huston and films like The Searchers, and we've mentioned High Noon, we've mentioned that. Actually, does that make Dodo the Grace Kelly part in this?
Only their mothers could tell them apart. Yeah, so anyway. So, and we go from that incredible comedy to that fantastic scene between the Doctor and Doc Holliday, because what we haven't mentioned is that the celestial toymaker, I'm trying to expunge that from my memory, did Billy Bunter give him some poison toffee or something?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, he had these sweets.
Bag of sweets.
Which he gave the whole bag to Dodo, but she didn't have any, so she offered them to the Doctor.
And of course,
and the Doctor breaks his tooth.
Yeah. Mm.
And so the Doctor has to go to a dentist. And so he goes to Doc Holliday. And, you know, Doc Holliday, there's all that business with the drink. You know, the Doctor says, oh, I never touch the stuff. And Doc Holliday says, oh, I do. And he starts getting drunk because it's like his first.
And Billy just gives him the whole sort of Lana from Archer side eye. Like, are you really doing that? Yeah, I mean, it's... And getting back to something we've been talking about for the last three podcasts, Doctor Who stops being so nasty.
People kind of go,
you know, why do Stephen and Dodo rush off into this dangerous environment? It's because compared to what they've had over the last few weeks, with Stephen being chased by Daleks and everyone he meets in the course of that being killed, and them releasing a plague upon the human race, and the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve, named after the event at which it didn't take place, shush, and and, you know, the celestial toymaker and electrical law, they're finally, it's this environment, it's like a watery oasis in the middle of a desert. Of course they're gonna just jump in and go, yeah, this is brilliant. And then of course by the end of episode one go, oh, actually, we're in hideous danger.
I mean, well, they're actually fans of Westerns themselves, too. I always wanted to be a cowboy. I always wanted to be a cowgirl. Like, they've clearly watched them at the movies or whatever. So, or what do you have in the future where Stephen comes from? Holographic brain implants or something. But they're watching Western ones of those. So they're excited by this. And then we have the scene with the Doctor and Doc Holliday. And there we have, like, just about my favourite cliffhanger ever, which is the Doctor walking along, like, we've got Stephen and Dodo, they're in the thing, they're being forced by the Clantons to play Linda Barron's song, and they're doing that, and, like, Dodo's discovered how to play the piano, Vicky probably left some pills of, the how to play the piano course that she did at nursery school, you know, so they've been left in the TARDIS. She can suddenly play the piano. Stephen's singing the song, which is just sort of spectacular and wonderful. The Clantons are all waiting for Doc Holliday to come along because they're going to kill him. Doc Holliday has tricked the Doctor into taking on his identity. He's clutching his face because he set his tooth out, and he's got a gun, which is kind of going, why do I have a gun?
Yeah.
And he's kind of walking along, and then it sort of fades out. It's kind of low key, but there's danger and comedy and just everything in it. Mm. I think it's a real, real high point.
Yeah. I think at this point we should talk about the song, which permeates the entire story. I'm going to go out there and start off by saying I think it's a very good idea, because, again, it's one of the tropes of the Western. And it's used to pretty good effect. Occasionally it doesn't work. There's a bit in, I think it's episode 3 or 4, where Johnny Ringo finds Kate, and the verse actually goes, Johnny Ringo has found her, Johnny Ringo's found Kate, Johnny Ringo has seen her. Right, so the last three lines are exactly the same thing. And it happens a couple of times. Other times it's very witty, like he's gone kind of mental from Earth's heavy blow. You know, that's quite good. And the verse about Charlie the barman dying. But it just seems like sometimes Tristram Carey is just sitting at his kitchen table at 1 a.m. going, I just want to finish this.
It is, but that's terrific too. And Charlie gets killed by Johnny Ringo. And when does Johnny Ringo come in? Episode 3 or 4?
It must be episode 3, yes.
And it's slightly like the Mythmakers in that it's all sort of fun and frolics.
And then and then someone's killed.
And then it all ends in a sort of giant.
This is the thing, isn't it? We've got another story. Just as the Westerns, you know, in 1960 you had 35 different TV, American-made TV series of Westerns around the world. Australia and Britain didn't get all of them, but we certainly got the best of the best of them. But by the mid-60s, there were shows like The Wild Wild West. Do you know about that one?
Oh,
which was a spoof.
Yeah.
They made an awful film version a few years ago.
Will Smith. Yeah.
But it was a kind of a send-up of Westerns. Or you were getting things like Sergio Leone making his spaghetti Westerns with those beautiful Ennio Morricone scores. But they were looking at it a bit sideways, as in a kind of a True Grit is probably the best one of them. It was starting to be seen as something tawdry and sad and lost. It was looking at ancient history. It was the Middle Ages already. So something that's not just 100 years ago. It was all now spies in space. So doing a Western was a kind of tongue-in-cheek thing. Again, this is almost another Mythmakers, where it starts off really jolly. Yeah. You kind of know, so again, with the people we've got on screen, it's Dodo and Steven, something horrible is going to happen to just about bloody everybody.
And it is also because we kind of know the OK Corral and the gunfight, but it is also because Linda Barron is singing about it right from the get-go. We know that it's sort of leading up to that. And then Johnny Ringo comes in and shoots Charlie the barman, and then it sort of starts to get a bit nasty.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those deaths, the deaths that all happen, all get commemorated in her song as well.
We don't
just get to, and we, you know, Charlie the barman is lying dead on the bar while we get a whole verse of it, you know, and he's been kind of sweet and he's sort of starstruck when he meets Johnny Ringo and, you know, like kind of excited and stuff, and that's all sort of really quite horrible. So there's sort of darkness to it, but I just don't feel like grindingly, you know, it's not
the tone is far better balanced than in The Mythmakers.
Yeah.
I think The Mythmakers is a better script, but I think Gunfighters balances its excesses better.
I mean, it's hard to tell, and maybe I would like The Mythmakers more if it existed and it wasn't just a slideshow. But the production of this is so great, and everyone's so funny. Mm. Stephen is hilarious. Dodo gets some great bits. Like
Dodo is finally playing exactly in the right space, you know, outside of any expectation. You don't need a back character to do this, and just like Stephen doesn't.
And Jackie Lane is actually really good.
They're all having fun, aren't
her
they?
Comic, yeah. I would say she's got better comic timing than Peter Purvis.
She is really funny in it. She is terrific. Yeah.
She was well respected before she got into Doctor Who. So
she's got that wonderful bit where she pulls the gun on Doc Holliday.
Yeah,
and it's just the two of them. Yeah, well, she faints when she realizes he had a gun and could have killed her at any moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you know, it's still allowing her to be a vulnerable character, but giving her strength, like they used to do with Vicky, and like hasn't really happened to Dodo until this point. She's also the only one of the three leads involved in the gunfight at the end.
That's true.
Yeah, where does Billy go?
Well, Billy's out at the Clanton Farm. He goes there to try and stop them, but they've already left.
Weirdly.
Yeah, and he was filmed arriving at the aftermath of the gunfight with Pa Clanton, and Pa Clanton tries to attack Wyatt Earp, and Kate, the songstress, saves him and stops him and says, "Look, it's pointless. Your sons are dead, etc." But they cut that bit. They decided we'll end on the feet.
Right.
You know, the famous feet standing together of Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp and what have you.
And it is, I mean, it does commit the sin that other historicals commit, which is to make the Doctor peripheral to the action. And so the Doctor kind of has to escape at the end, really, rather than doing anything to resolve anything. So, you know, as the show moves into something where it's about the Doctor as a hero and the Doctor sort of doing things, you know, like historicals become increasingly problematic.
I mean,
he does learn how to solve incidents, you know, after being mistaken for Doc Holliday through it. He does finally continue Doc's habit of smacking Dodo on the bum.
Does he smack Dodo on the bum? Yeah, because they give them a wanted poster at the end. Like, here's a souvenir of the Old West, and Dodo says something, and he just smacks her on the bum to get her into the TARDIS with the thing, not with his hand. No,
he doesn't give her a good, jolly good smack.
But you know, it's the kind of thing you can imagine one of the modern Doctors
carrying on in the TARDIS.
Perhaps not Peter Capaldi. You know, by the time this podcast goes out, we will have had three or four Peter Capaldi episodes.
We will have.
Yes.
We'll be old hands. We'll be sick of him. Don't you think? When's the next guy coming?
We'll have to get t-shirts. Come back, Matt Smith, all was forgiven. That's in the next podcast.
Yeah, so what else do we have?
It's much, much better than people give it credit for.
It's good.
So long as you kind of accept that as much as it is a Western in itself, it's also sending up the Western slightly.
And look who's making it. It's Donald Cochran's writing and Rex Tucker. Rex Tucker, for an hour, was the producer of the first series of Doctor Who.
Mm. Yeah.
You know.
Oh, no, I really think it's spectacular. It's one of my absolute favourite Hartnells. Seeing it again in context, it was so nice to see a story where the Doctor wasn't in some way sidelined or wasn't horribly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And where he's enjoying himself, like he's doing some great comedy acting. He's, you know, fun and funny and all sorts of things. I really like him. I think I've just read what Rod had to say about the Gunfighters. He hated it.
He hated it.
So really? What did he say?
He agreed with me that the song was everything that just happened. I just saw that, you stupid woman. He also
That's Nurse Gladys Emanuel, he's saying.
He also said, I have nothing against Linda Barron, but why did she not lose her voice and Julie Andrews did? However, there was one really good scene for Dodo. It was very nice to see Stephen in chaps.
I don't know what that means.
He does fancy Stephen quite a bit. So past comments about Stephen I hadn't mentioned until now. Rod said that he actually had the striped top that Stephen had, but he had it in the 1970s, and he said he looked much better in it than Stephen did, and Stephen didn't look too bad in it either. And also apparently way back in the massacre, and this is something you may want to watch it for again. Stephen's showy outfit left nothing to the imagination. I'm quite impressed.
Yeah, that is not going to make me rewatch that. I can tell you that.
I think it's time to leave Tombstone. Oh,
goodbye. Yes, and a jolly good smack bottom to everyone involved. It's really worth watching. It's thoroughly enjoyable and funny. And just like those little segue stories in Star Trek Next Generation, where they do
a fistful of daters.
Well, or Raymond, exactly. I was going to say, or a Raymond Chandler with one when they do the film.
Oh, the Royale.
Yeah, exactly.
No, the big goodbye, the long
the goodbye. Big long goodbye. But whenever they go into standard other styles of storytelling, yeah, exactly. And you can just see the whole cast having a whole lot of fun and everyone feeling like they're on holiday.
Yeah.
This one does that.
Yeah.
It's got a sterling cast. It's got David Graham and Shane Rimmer straight from finishing their final voice recordings for Thunderbirds, and then
and
2 weeks
Graham's
later,
David Graham's a Dalek, isn't he?
He's also a Dalek, so we own him many times.
And then you've got Lawrence
Harvey,
Lawrence Payne. Who's Johnny Lawrence Ringo? Payne. Who's fabulous.
Do you know who was actually originally cast for that role, but they couldn't get him? But he turns up in Doctor Who later on. Oh, a little known actor called Patrick Troughton.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Right. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Johnny Ringo. Wouldn't that have been amazing? Yeah, first cast, but
now,
available.
And interestingly about Lawrence Payne, because by the time Lawrence Payne reappears in Doctor Who in the 80s, he'd retired from acting.
He did play in Westerns, legitimately.
Yeah, oh, yes, Payne. Absolutely.
With
yeah.
that accent.
He's actually good.
Well, that's the thing. He doesn't try to put on an accent.
That is
well,
him.
He sort of does.
No, he's...
Compared to the other... He sort of puts
it's
on...
It's not as terrible as anyone else's, but it's not good. It's like someone once showed him a map.
If I'm wrong, but I think he's a Yank.
Oh, I don't know. But, you see, I had heard he'd retired because he had an eye injury and lost most of the vision in one eye. But that had already happened at this point.
Oh, really?
It was during a sword fight.
Wow. Yeah,
He pretty much took a sword to the eye. And, yeah, lost most of the vision in one eye.
I think that's why Dastari wears those glasses.
Yeah, as he got older, I believe he needed the glasses in the Spanish sunshine, so they retroactively applied it. But, yeah, I mean, God, he...
And his Morris.
We should mention that Lawrence Payne had also played Athos in Rex Tucker's 1950s version of The Three Musketeers.
That's where he got his injury, I believe.
Yeah, and Porthos was Paul Whitson-Jones. Do you think Peter Capaldi was in that version as well?
Paul Whitson-Jones. Imagine seeing him with a sabre.
Yeah,
you
like
know.
The Brian Blessed of his day. Did you know who Aramis was in that one?
Nope.
Roger Delgado. We've got to find it somewhere. I don't think it exists.
You know, I think
some real luminary talents in this. Yeah, let's check it down.
It was probably done on film. If anyone knows, please let us know. I mean, we may find it before this point.
We'll try.
I actually think Lawrence Payne is possibly... he's probably equal with Anthony Jacobs in terms of the best guest performance in this story.
Yeah, he is really good. And it is... I'm not sure that it's because he gets the accent right. I think it is because he's playing it in a different way. So the Clantons and Doc Holliday are playing it big. Do you know what I mean? And he comes in and sort of plays against that in order to be more menacing.
Yeah.
And so, like, his accent is still not great, but his performance is really striking.
He makes me think of a classic from my childhood, which is Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh, God. And why is that from your childhood, Brendan?
But the villain who turns up in that, sort of everyone's playing it at one level, and then Christopher Lloyd as the villain comes in, and he is just completely... He's still cartoony, but he's just completely dark and evil.
Yeah.
And that's what Johnny Ringo's like. Sort of the Clantons and versus Holliday, there's a bit of jovial fun in there, and, you know, they want to kill him, but they want to have a laugh along with it. Whereas Johnny Ringo's just, no, you've called me here to kill someone. Yeah, don't muck about. We're going to do this. And as you say, that's so effective because both styles are still utterly believable in this context. Yeah. And I think just before we move on, it's worth mentioning, of course, Anthony Jacobs' other connection to Doctor Who. His son, Matthew Jacobs, wrote the script for the Paul McGann telemovie. And he was on the
set, you know.
And he was on the set. And I've seen an interview with him, and he's
lovely. And what's the Eighth Doctor wear? Whose costume does he wear?
Wild Bill Hickok, yeah. Mm.
Spoiler alert, I really hate that.
Okay, well...
I'll tell you more about it in 2016.
Rebecca Massacre.
Oh, by the way, did I mention that?
Well, moving on to something that I think... Spoiler alert, we're all going to enjoy. It's the Savages.
Yeah, I think we are. I like the score of that.
Yeah, isn't the score weird? It's got all these strings. Mm. It's like, do you remember it, Brendan? It's like, really extraordinary. It's like nothing... Who is it, Richard? Do you know? It's very, very strange and very different from whatever we've heard before. And so, I mean, there are some things here that we've never seen before. Well, I mean, let's talk about the status of the story first. It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
It's right towards the end of Series 3. Nearly no one's seen it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's really forgotten.
I had not seen the recon or heard the audio until... I watched it with Rod. It was the first story that he had seen for the first time that I had also seen for the first time. So it's very interesting in that regard.
Well, I mean, I've had that experience just sort of recently with a few things. I'd never seen The Mythmakers before. I'd never seen Marco Polo before. Mm. You know, there's heaps of stuff that I'm now seeing for the first time. But The Savages was one that where I didn't really have any idea of what I was supposed to think about it. You know, I didn't really know what the opinion was meant to be. And certainly I'd heard the plot described, and it didn't seem all that interesting. But in fact, it actually ends up being really surprisingly strong. I liked it a great deal. And it's kind of a bit of a tonic after the arc to have a story that is about colonialism or really about any form of oppression. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have to be about colonialism, although the race thing, because, you know, we've got blackface. And
although he's not actually black, it's sort of an orangey bronze. Yeah. It's a sort of gold, maybe.
But he's darker, you know, like Frederick Jaeger.
It's the received BBC way of any guy playing Othello.
So, you know, that's sort of problematic in modern terms and stuff, but not everyone is sort of consistently blackface. Like Avon, isn't there a character called Avon and his girlfriend? Like
they read this again.
Ian Stuart Black.
The War Machine
I've just looked it up. Raymond Jones did the music, who also did the music for the Romans.
Okay. Oh. This is really different from the Romans, though. It's really, really striking. It's wonderful.
Do you know what this feels to me like? And again, because BBC didn't get Star Trek until the very late 60s. This feels like an episode of Trek.
It does have a Star Trek sort of feel to it.
The Flower Children, being obvious, but it does.
It's that allegorical high concept thing. And Ian Stuart Black will do it again. I've just watched Macroterra, which I've heard before.
Oh, I love that.
And I think Macroterra is like a satire of, like, it's an attack on capitalism. And I think that this is attack on colonialism, but it's blackface and stuff aside, it's unspecific enough for it to be an attack on oppression generally. And so what you have is the elders, and they live off the life energy of the savages. And whether you interpret that as an allegory for, you know, coming to their country and enslaving and exploiting them and taking their resources.
Well, it's old guys sucking the vital juices out of young local primitives. And have we mentioned Peter Capaldi's?
No, but do you know what I mean? Like, it could be that, or it could just be capitalism, you know, like wage slavery or whatever.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it works with any form of oppression. And, like, it's done so strongly. So the very first episode has Exors hunting, I want to say Nanina or something.
Yes. Anyway, pretty gorgeous
young woman. Child, yeah, she's called person. Nanina. It's Exorcist Nanina.
It's very and George Palligan.
She's blonde.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She's very blonde, pretty, and, you know, she gets captured and put in a special machine that takes out her life essence. And we're all vague about that because that's what the allegory's about.
Yeah.
But she's so horribly traumatized by it, and it's like she's begging not to be.
It's a shock, isn't
it? Really, really kind of, you know, a bit awful. And all the elders live in sort of luxury and happiness, and you know, they've achieved a great deal, and they're massively leisured and massively educated, and they live in great comfort, and they're super pleased with themselves, you know. And even the doctor is sort of impressed by their society until he discovers, you know, in fact, what it's built on.
Right.
And we don't see this from Billy enough or very much, but it becomes Troughton's standard operating thing, which is why I think Macroterra is slightly more successful than this at doing the same job. It's revolution, and he wants to overthrow the society sort of thing. But before he can do that, of course, he's put in the machine, and his life essence gets taken out by Jano.
And he's left in there for quite a while.
Does he get a week off?
Well, not quite. There is one episode where he doesn't do much, but he is still there because there's a little bit of existing footage. It's this whole thing of, it's a story that not only manages to give the Doctor a really strong moral role to do, but it gives him time to actually be endangered, and that gives the narrative a sense of, okay, no, the Doctor's really in danger here, and he's having his life has been sucked out, and we've seen what that's done to Nanina.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? And, of course, that leads to a brilliant performance by Frederick Jaeger impersonating the Doctor. Impersonating William Hartnell.
Yeah, so Frederick Jaeger
he's terrific.
He'll go on to be in Doctor Who again. He'll be Sorensen, and he'll be Professor Marius, who created K-9. And he, I'm not sure that he's that terrific. He does.
Do you think they were tipping him to actually, like it's a recording to see how he would have gone?
Yeah, it is.
Billy?
Possibly.
You know, because
the kind
so
of thing they
many,
would have done. Yeah. Don't forget, this is Innes Lloyd's story.
And yeah,
and they're really trying to get rid of him. Experimenting, you know what I mean?
With things they can do.
So, you know, I'm not sure it's a great Hartnell that he does, but it's sort of passable. And now that I think about it, it is that thing. He doesn't get a week off, does he? Hartnell gets dragged through tunnels.
No, it isn't. He was there watching Freddy Jaeger as well.
And but he gets dragged through tunnels, and he's kind of incapacitated, and he can't act.
Yeah, yeah.
He can't do anything. So he's completely kind of, like, they really, really suck out his life essence. He's sort of a zombie for an episode.
Yeah.
And the thing that happens to Jano is, of course...
Hello, Sutek.
Sutek.
Jano?
Yes, she agrees, yes.
Hello, sweetheart. So what happens to Jano is a science fiction thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, he feeds on the Doctor's life energy, and he gains a conscience. He realizes that their exploitation of the savages is immoral. All right. But I think what's really clever is that there's a parallel story going on as well, because Exors gets captured by the savages and they're going to kill him. And Nanina, whom he had captured and mistreated earlier, intercedes on his behalf. And because she does something kind, do you know what I mean? Even though she had every right to take revenge on him, he's won over. Like, he's convinced that these are people. And so while there's a kind of slightly stupid science fiction thing going on to convince Jano to switch sides, what convinces Exors to switch sides is the realization that the savages are people just like him, that they're not outside the boundaries of his moral concern. And that's, you know, in order to exploit people, in order to mistreat them, we have to kind of say, well, we have no responsibility to treat them morally. And that's what the elders do conspicuously. They regard the savages as animals. They say that the savages can be exploited. And it's an act of kindness that, you know, that turns things around. And I think it's, I think that's terribly clever. I think had it just been, you know, the magical life essence thing, that would have been slightly more crap.
It's just as you say, it's sort of the difference a production team makes. Because by now you've got Innes Lloyd as producer, and Innes Lloyd comes in even quicker than John Wiles came in and just takes the reins far quicker. And you've got Jerry Davis as well. John Wiles' ideal sci-fi story, if you like, was The Ark.
Yeah.
And Innes Lloyd, this isn't even necessarily his ideal sci-fi story, but his first sci-fi story he manages to pull out is this complex moral allegory about exploitation and about... It can be about racism, it can be about sexism, it can be about all these things. And it gives each of the regulars something interesting to do, it gives the guest cast something interesting to do, and it's just all of a sudden Doctor Who's adult again, and dark, and hopeful at the same time, rather than suddenly veering violently between the two. It's such...
This is really poignant, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is poignant for how Australia is being seen, but not so much by, I guess, by ourselves, by some of us, but by the rest of the world, because the allegory of how the elders live in a free state and see themselves as morally justified is how, can I say it, is how we're treating the asylum seekers coming to Australia by boat. And look at the way the rest of the world is seeing us right now. This is absolutely of the time.
But it does work for any kind of oppression that you identify. Do you know what I mean? Like, the starting point is clearly race, just because of Jano, Frederick Jaeger. I wanted to say both of those at the same time. But because he's in blackface, you know, there's a race thing. But it does work with anything. And I think, like, as I said, I've just watched The Macroterra. I think Ian Stuart Black is writing very, very much about capitalism in The Macroterra. And so you've had a program that has been kind of racist and kind of opposed to Vicky and opposed to strong women and, like, just slightly politically nasty for a while, and now it's Doctor Who again. You know, he incites revolution against oppressive people, but more than that, he convinces the oppressive people that they've done the wrong thing, and the whole thing ends with them taking machines and smashing up the room, the preparation room thing, and talking about how much they enjoy it. Like, there's dialogue in there about how much fun it is to smash the system. So I think it's a real unsung gem.
Yeah. And also that feeds into the departure of Stephen.
Can we talk about Stephen?
I think we should. And arguably it's the most telegraphed leaving of a Hartnell companion, because all the way through, I mean, because of course the Doctor's incapacitated early on, so Stephen takes the lead once again, and Stephen is talking to people on both sides and saying, but look, this is wrong and I don't trust this and you shouldn't, what about this, what about that? Stephen's actually coming into this status quo and saying, okay, so you've got this system of plenty, where's the plenty coming from? You know, and to for your comparison, Richard, he's actually a kind of politician who's saying, okay, but you need to understand your environment and what you're getting out of your environment. Okay, so you're saying the people out there are evil. Why are they evil? Okay, they look funny? What? No, that's not good. What? That's not good enough. So, I mean, not only is Stephen the sort of moral compass for the allegory, of course the Doctor's very moral as well, and Dodo, when she finds out what's going on, is appalled.
There's this great line about Dodo, where Dodo wanders off, doesn't she?
Yes.
And, like, the horrible upper-class people who are, you know, Avon and Samira or something. What's she called? I can't remember.
Yes.
Avon and what's-her-face. And she wanders off and they go, oh, you know, she can't possibly have gone anywhere. And she's sort of wandering through the tunnels and stuff. And I think Stephen follows her and says, you know, even Dodo wouldn't have been that stupid.
Ouch.
But Dodo discovers it and is horrified. Yeah, like, and so she actually has a sort of decent role to play here.
Yeah, once again, you know, get a decent writer and a producer who cares about women.
Yeah, yeah.
You start getting that decent part there. But yeah, Stephen shows sort of how much he has learned from the Doctor. And in the end, he even says, you know, Doctor, okay, yeah, if you think I'm ready for this, yeah, then I will. I will do this thing. It's heartrending, but once again, it actually feels kind of appropriate that Stephen would go off and do this thing.
It's a real high note in the series, that the companion finally leaves on a point of strength and by his own volition. And maybe because it's a boy, actually to call his own shot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, Ian and Barbara leave in a sort of good way.
Yeah,
but it is a bit different, isn't it? Yeah. They're grown-ups, and they're kind of people, and they need to go back to Earth for, like, no other solution would work. Do you know what I mean? Like, imagine the Doctor had pushed them out somewhere, you know, in ruined London or ancient Troy or
you
something.
That
would just been terrible. It couldn't have worked. But we're at the point, we're past the point now where the companions are anything resembling real people, and who cares? And so Stephen gets a really good send off, and given that he has de facto been the lead of the show for a while,
yes.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. He deserves to be the leader of something, and so I think that works terribly well.
And something that's really nice about it is Peter Purvis's own reaction to that, because he knew his contract was up, and he said, "No, I don't want to do any more." And when he got it, he's like, "Yeah, that's actually a good way to go out." And he's always said that if they ever came back to Stephen, he would actually like to see that Stephen had become corrupted by power, because he still felt that even though Stephen was a good and noble character, whenever you have someone in a position of power, because he's like, Stephen wasn't elected, he was just put in this position, so who's to say he won't still be there in 50 years? And he said, I'd like to see Stephen come back and be a despot, but be reminded how to be good by meeting the Doctor again.
Ah, yeah.
And, you know,
I'm sure he would have just retired and, you know, maybe...
You'd think
gone,
so, but
yeah, spent more time with his hair, perhaps.
But, you know, it just goes to show that... I think I said earlier, but the mic wasn't on when we were just setting up. Stephen is like Mel. You know, he's not much of a character, but an actor going, okay, I haven't got much to work with, but I'm going to give a very good, very morally centred performance and just do the best I can
Is that the Jenna Coleman side?
Jenna Coleman now. Again, she's a fantastic actress. I really enjoy watching her, but she's given very little character to work with.
Interchangeable parents.
Yeah, no, I never really understood that. But... you know, Stephen has been more important to the show than either of them.
Oh, God,
do you know
yes.
what I mean? In that it's really early on, and you virtually... you have a production team trying to ease Hartnell out, and so they rely on Stephen, and, you know, like, the massacre is the Stephen show, and you know, Stephen and Dodo are doing the Celestial Toy Maker, and, like, again and again, Stephen is the person who has kept the show going.
Mm.
And he is good. He's fun to watch, isn't he? He's got some charisma and things.
I mean, I suppose that's why he's got so little... You know, when you talk about Stephen, you go, oh, yeah, he's a space pirate and he's very brave, but he doesn't have a very complex character, because the Doctor at this point is not a complex character. The Doctor is... he's played in a very complex way, but you can't define him because so little is known about him. And that's because he needs to be so many things.
Yeah.
And so
he's
when
very
Stephen,
much of the moment.
Yeah.
The Doctor is always the set. That's why he's the centre of the narrative. He's kind of exists slightly outside it.
Exactly. And that's the case with Stephen in those stories. I mean, if you look at Ian, you know, you can describe Ian as very brave. But in a situation, you know how Ian will act.
Yeah.
You know that Ian will grab a gun or a sword and say, right, we'll take it to them. You know that Barbara will turn around and say, no, we've got to think of a logical way out of this. You know that Vicky will be a bit quirky and a bit witty and a bit charming.
And
revolutionary. But with Stephen, you know, he can do the fighting, he can do the biff, he can do the, I'm so angry, I'm so frustrated, I'm going to do something silly, and he can do the whole standing up to racism and oppression
kind of thing. He can do the muling in an airlock.
I think you're onto something there, Nathan. Because he takes over the lead, that is when he loses some of the definition in his character, because he has to be all things to all men.
I think even, you know, Richard, were you talking earlier about the scene with the it was the Stephen is trying to charge the fake Terranium Core.
Oh yeah, that was me.
That was you.
Yeah.
Stephen's trying to charge the fake Terranium Core, and he electrocutes himself, and there's a plot point based on the fact that he's from further back in time than But in fact, you know, after that, it doesn't matter where he's from or what his background is. Nothing is ever mentioned about what year he's from or what his job was or anything about his background at all. It becomes completely irrelevant. He's merely a plot contrivance. And he's a charismatic well-acted plot contrivance, but essentially that's really all he is.
Yeah,
but we love him, and we're sorry that he's gone.
Just acts above me on that. Yeah, he's been the strongest centre in the stories this year.
Rod really enjoyed this one as well, and he picked up on something you mentioned earlier, the whole George Powell time machine.
Yeah.
Because in that, you know, you had a civilised perfect society, but it was controlled by the Morlocks. In this version, if you look at the savages as being the Morlocks, this is the civilized controlled society controlling the Morlocks. And it's like, no, this is far, far worse.
Yeah.
But Rod's other reaction to this story in terms of Stephen going was, because he really
loves Stephen. You're upsetting the cat.
Rod would be horrified to hear he upsets the cat. My boyfriend is the cat whisperer. I'm sorry, Sutek. I didn't mean to upset you.
And again.
Oh, reaction.
Oh, dear. Oh, I'm sorry. Can I get your cat, dear?
No, don't do that.
She'll scratch her eyes out.
Poor Sutek for nothing. Okay.
Do we have anything more to say on the savages?
Oh, she does. There you go. It's a terrific thing. I only know it as an audio, but I really like it as that. Yeah. Although apparently the visuals look great. It was Christopher Barry again, wasn't it?
Yes.
Third go. More caves.
It's our first quarry.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he does make a lot of what he uses from what we can tell.
The biggest location shoot since Dalek Invasion of Earth, I believe.
Yeah.
Lots of quarry stuff. Okay, so that can mean only one thing.
Have we just gone groovy and fab all of a sudden?
We've just gone groovy and fab. We've come back down to
Earth.
Is that
why we've all changed into these PVC A-line coats and train driver's caps?
Yes, Brendan, we've got our clothes on.
Well, I should hope so. Mine's orange PVC, by the way.
It just looks grey in the black and white footage. Yeah.
And despite what anyone else may hear, that's the creaking you may hear. No, we're coming back down to Earth. The TARDIS is coming back to 1966 for The War Machines, another story by Ian Stuart Black, who we just praised and adored for his work on The Savages. And also this comes from an idea by Kit Pedler, who had recently come on board as Doctor Who's unofficial scientific advisor. He's actually where the whole title of scientific advisor would later come from, as an homage to him. But he was a scientist. I believe he worked in optics science.
Yes.
Ophthalmology, I think, is the official term for that.
And so what was he advising them about here? Was he telling them how computers work?
Well, what he was doing was he was coming up with current scientific ideas that could be used in dramatic situations. So, yeah, his first idea was, you know, computers are beginning to network themselves. And what would happen if the computers decided they were better at running things after they networked themselves? So, you know, it's 80s concerns, really, such as Skynet in the Terminator films. But done in the 1960s, because the first email was sent in the 1950s, I believe. Mm. And so he was working from that principle that computers were starting to become more common. The post office tower had just opened and had a giant computer relaying all the telephone calls. So he, I think, had the idea of, what happens if this computer develops intelligence and goes rogue, and that's our concept here. It's Doctor Who's first mad computer.
It really is. There's a whole lot of, you know, we forget that how fearful culture and the world was about computers in the 60s. We were seeing them as things that could actually take over our world, and maybe through Facebook's instant messenger we're about to find out if you've adopted that it might actually start to be happening. Well, in fact, we mentioned this in a previous podcast, that we had Dr. Stephen Hawking recently saying the thing you've got to most fear is not a virus or climate change, it's AI, it's computers getting smart.
Was someone else. Who was that?
Yeah, Stephen Hawking just said it this year in a press release earlier this year. Yeah, it's all getting horribly Nazi. Okay, Wotan is the leader of the Nibelungen, and you've got Wagner's da-da-da-da-da, which is getting a bit Nazi. But don't forget, IBM started out with the Fortran card process. The whole beginning of modern computing, how it's able to organize information, it was designed for the National Socialist Party in organizing all the persons who were going to be taken away to the camps. Every single person had a card. That's where the tech has come from.
But it also comes,
knew this in the 60s.
Yeah, it also comes, you know, like the whole computer thing as well. You've got the Enigma machine and all of that. So like so many developments in the modern world, it is propelled by the Second World War.
Yes.
But through the exegesis of, through the filters of Nazism and now communism, don't forget when Polly starts to be taken over, she sounds exactly like Madame Mao again in her pronouncements from mainland China, whereas Dodo just turns into I don't know what when she's taken over. I really feel this is about the threat of computers. This is the first time that we've actually seen the Doctor have a truly somatic reaction to an ongoing or an ontological
threat. Like he feels evil, he can sense evil.
He gets a skin rash from it. He says, my skin is... And you can just see there's genuine... You haven't seen genuine fear in the Doctor very often, which then, of course, triumphs in that my favourite cliffhanger maybe
awesome.
So far is when he does that whole fantastic pre-Capaldi standoff with
at the end of episode 3.
Yeah. Is this our favourite villain monster machine since... the Daleks themselves.
All I can remember... Do you remember them in Blue Peter? It must be a DVD extra Blue Peter and stuff.
And smash some cardboard boxes.
They smash some cardboard boxes. So and they're clearly made of sort of painted wood. And bizarrely, they're built in one night. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of we invent the plans for the thing, we send it out, then the next morning they're sort of out smashing things up. It takes no time at all.
Because all they have to be is a relay. Wotan's the intelligence running them.
And once again,
such a nerdy moment there.
we're seeing Doctor Who move into the territory of the Avengers, where things do happen overnight. Avengers. Like a villain will come up with the plan, and then the plan will happen, or the plan will already be in motion when the story starts.
In fact, it is a bigger deal than that, because this is actually the first contemporary Earth story.
It's very Quatermass, though, we should throw in nods to Nigel Neale. The Doctor is Professor Quatermass.
Well, because instantly he comes back to Earth. We've never seen him on Earth before, except in Planet of Giants, where he doesn't interact with anyone.
No, because he's all action figure scale at that point.
Yes, but here
he has a backstory. He knows people.
He knows people. He's friends with Sir Charles. You know,
He's a bit more Third Doctor than we expect. You can see him having whiny, cheesy chat-offs with Sir Charles and his mates. You can see him starting to name-drop. Actually, I don't know that we would have loved him so much had he been around in contemporary London. He's much more of a rebel when we see him before this.
In a way, you know, it's taken them 3 years, but they've actually done the idea that Sidney Newman hated. This is the Troubleshooters.
We're back to episode 0.
Although the difference is... it's a troubleshooting team of one. Like, Dodo, Ben and Polly, none of them have scientific training like the proposed troubleshooters was, so it's just the Doctor Who scientists. But Polly and Ben are very intelligent and very resourceful. And Dodo, unfortunately, she's just had two really strong stories.
And
it's the end of her contract mid-story, and in a way, understandably, Innes Lloyd wants to make his own mark on the programme. Dodo is just sort of shipped off very unceremoniously, you know, and she was on location. They could have filmed a leaving scene for her for episode 4. And the only thing, literally the only thing I can think of that they didn't do it is they would have had to pay her for an extra episode.
What did they do? They just say Dodo says she's in the country and she'll be fine.
She'll be fine. She sends her love. And we never see her again.
But this, I think, is where we actually start to get things right. This is the show starting to reboot itself. And we're going to see that early next year. Because, spoiler alert, they're going to replace Bill Hartnell. But they start doing it here. So you've got Dodo. Right, we've come back to Earth. And Earth is very different from when we left it, okay? London, contemporary London, isn't full of sort of tweedy sort of 1950s school teachers.
You've got mod, rocking Adam Faith characters like the brand new boy Ben.
Yeah.
You've never had anyone more contemporary than that.
No, exactly. Both Ben and Polly, like, they're attractive young people. They're kind of, you know, relatable. We see them at the hilarious Inferno nightclub, which is
the hottest spot in town.
Everyone's there.
Just so you know, you're still on the BBC.
And everyone's sort of dancing, and Ben beats someone up who's trying to hit on Polly, and Polly knows, like, everyone, and she's sort of fab, and they're on the phone.
They look beautiful, and they're startling. They just don't fit. But this is a lovely thing, when as soon as Billy walks in and he's told his gear is fab, I think that gear in the 60s didn't mean what it means right now for any children who might be listening. It's not a drug reference, but but he actually does fit into this really well. You don't expect it.
He's sort of Adamant.
We've mentioned Adamant.
That said aloud before.
Adamant lives.
Yeah. I actually pronounce it wrong. It is Adamant.
Adamant lives. Yeah, that apparently didn't work so well for her, but that was the spin-off. She wanted to make Sexton Blake, starring Lawrence Payne, as it later ITV did it instead, and so she made this thing. Well, look, I haven't seen Adamant, but I'm told it's terrific. The Edwardian mod thing that goes together so well. The Avengers were doing it. Look, Steed is trad to Emma's mod, as the 1967 annual so adroitly put it. Billy fits perfectly into the 60s, never more so than now. Can I just say that, again, in perfect alternate universe, I would have liked a year, much as we love what's going to come up, just a year of Ben and Polly and Billy being looked after by those two, instead of maybe we know what was going on behind the scenes and that Billy knew that his days were there and he wasn't that happy with these kids.
And certainly Annika doesn't say nice things about
him. She doesn't, and maybe this is the point to say that I kind of side with, maybe it's Sandover who says that, you know, actually, she's still around, and all due deference to her. She's not perhaps as sympathetic to Billy as a young person as she was then, as maybe we would be now. I know how I would have liked to have seen this play out. A whole year of those three would have been terrific.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been great. And the year that we get of Ben and Polly is terrific. They're both really good characters. And it is getting back to where we started, which is two contemporary people, you know, a man and a woman who join the Doctor on his adventures, so that we have someone that we can relate to. It's not space people with no background. You know, it's not even people from the future. It's people from now. And it's people from a version of now that's a little bit more contemporary, a little bit less dated than Ian and Barbara. However much we love Ian and Barbara, and God, we love them, you know, they're fantastic. Ben and Polly are, they almost seem like a generation later rather than just 2 years later. And so I think that they're really terrific. And Richard, your point where the Doctor fits in, I think is absolutely right. The person who doesn't fit in is Dodo, who just looks massively incongruous in the nightclub. Like, what is she wearing? You know, she just doesn't seem like she comes from the same world at all as these other people. Yeah. And it is that thing where she also is barely a person. You know, she came in, she had like two lines about her background. Oh, my mum's dead, and now I'm going to suddenly change my accent for no reason. You know, like, she's just really not being great. I think I have absolutely no doubt that it has nothing at all to do with Jackie Lane as an actor. I really think that she's the victim of them not knowing what to do with the program and them essentially flailing for all of this time. It's the new girl. What does she do? Oh, she'll have to change accent because this is terrible. You know, like, all of that's just...
But I have to say, look how good Jenna Coleman is with pretty much the same level of backstory.
But I think more...
That leaf does not count for an entire narrative.
I think, though, more care is taken with direction of her and overall treatment of her.
That's true. She's definitely treated better. Yeah. They can't get away with doing the same.
No, no. And you know, we're now at the tail end of a paradigm where Doctor Who is a man and a woman.
Yeah.
You know, essentially there's two leads, whereas here it's still Bill Hartnell and some people who we might or might not care about, you know, now that Ian and Barbara have left. So it was all just a bit of an undistinguished run of episodes. But, you know, bless Jackie. I'm sure it had nothing to do with her.
But
she's great in The Gunfighters. Mm.
And in terms of the show itself, in these last three stories, it's really starting to get back on its feet.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it had just been slowly put down to the ground in a chokehold, and it's gotten up swinging in more ways than one.
Yeah, yeah.
It is just a shame with Jackie Lane. And now it's time for my exciting Jackie Lane story. It may not actually be exciting. Disclaimer.
Is it the worst goodbye of a companion we've seen so far?
It's the worst goodbye we've seen to date.
It's worse than Donna Noble's virtual mind rape when everything's taken away from her. Is that not a word I can use? It makes me so sad. I felt really distraught at the end of that.
That's the thing. It makes you sad, but it makes you feel something. Dodo's won
Liz
all
Shaw.
You...
Liz Shaw.
No, Liz Shaw. That's a poor.
Yeah.
Oh, because we'll
get to it.
But unlike Dodo, that's not the actress being treated poorly.
Well, not on screen, no. So.
Well, she didn't want to come back either.
Anyway,
so funny, possibly not funny, Jackie Lane story. In the lead up to recording this podcast, I decided I would look around for more stuff that Jackie Lane did, because like you, Richard, I'd heard reviews that she was good in other things. She'd done a lot of the soaps of the day. She'd been a regular on some of them. And then her only acting credit after Doctor Who, because of course she did become an actor's agent and a voice artiste agent and very successful in that line of work. Her only credit after Doctor Who I discovered on IMDb was an episode of Get Smart about 3 years later. And I thought, that's not out of the question, because John Levine went over to America and did a fair bit of work in America after he finished on Doctor Who. And I thought, 3 years, that's enough time for her to go over, just be getting bit parts and finally get a speaking part. And so I watched this particular episode of Get Smart. It's called The Day They Turned Out the Knights. Knights with a K.
Yes.
Premise is there's budget cutbacks at Control 99 is forced to...
become 66.
Well, no. She's actually fired and has to take a job in a shop. And so I thought, oh, great, Jackie Lane's going to be the girl in the shop. And no, she wasn't the girl in the shop. It's like, oh, there are customers. Jackie Lane's going to be a customer. So there's a few customers. And, you know, being America in the 60s, there was a customer who was an older woman. And I thought, is that Jackie Lane in makeup? No, it's not Jackie Lane in makeup. There was a black man customer wearing funky threads. No, that's not Jackie Lane. There were businessmen and what have you. Ba-di-da-di-da. So it gets to the end of the episode, and I still haven't seen Jackie Lane. And I'm like, oh, this is really weird. Get to the cast list, and like 5 credited cast aside from Jackie Lane. And so I pause it. And I'm like, okay, so we've got the leader of chaos in this episode is such and such, the other shop girl is such and such, warehouse man such and such, Larrabee such and such, hippie Jackie Lane.
No.
And I'm just like, but... And I was about to rewind it when I suddenly realised that I had seen a hippie as one of the customers.
Yeah.
And, you know, funky threads, headband, corduroy waistcoat. IMDb's messed it up. This is a black American male actor called Jackie Lane.
She's got the range.
She does have a range. She goes north. So, she goes up and down the M4.
So
she goes to Bradford. a lot of Jamaican people settled in Bradford.
It looks like we've finally seen someone who didn't do any work on television after Doctor Who. Even Carol Ann Ford and Maureen O'Brien, whose careers did take an unfortunate turn after Doctor Who got work after Doctor Who. It appears Jackie Lane did not, and that's really sad.
I think she probably decided against it. More about her a bit later.
Yes.
How we...
There's a lot of backstory stuff, you know, that Innes Lloyd was wanting to push this to be contemporary fab mod show. I think you can see that it's doing it, but Doctor Who can't just be one thing. The reason it works is you've got to let it go and do something different next week. That's its strength. Yeah.
And to be fair, they do that. Like, they bring the hip mod, fabulous, attractive young characters in, and then they put them in the Smugglers and the Tenth Planet and stuff like that. So,
they do.
Yeah, so they do that. And it is a return to the lovely Ian and Barbara. There's even that fan rumour that Polly's last name is Wright. We never hear it.
That's right. We do hear that.
We never hear it, but that's a thing.
Are we going to get another historical soon, I hope?
I believe we are.
Golly.
But,
because that's going to make everyone in this room happy, I can tell.
But that's for another podcast. Oh, so
we look forward to it.
I have to get home for a roast, and you've got a roast in the oven. So I think we very quickly have to do our Jenny Laird Awards for most puzzling creative choice.
Well, I'll let you start.
I'll go.
Yes, you go first, please. Nathan.
Well, I want Daphne Dare. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I'm sure she's a very nice person. In fact, I think Dougie Camfield and Daphne Dare can share this one.
Ooh.
And it is for just the absolutely astonishing and remarkable look and behavioural characteristics of the delegates in Mission to the Unknown and Dalek Master Plan. They're white with sort of black balls all over their face, or they're what did you say, like a bunch of kale in a hoodie.
Yes.
You know,
a cone head.
Yeah, cone head. You know, they walk into the thing sort of as if they're kind of floating. It's very, very strange. Everyone pulls out their sort of funniest, silly voice. You know, like, the whole thing is just absolutely bizarre. And we've seen, you know, shows like Rings of Akerson or yes. The Spectacular End of the World, which put lots of aliens on screen. But we've never really seen anything like this before, and we really will never see anything like it again. So, in fact, she's not credited for episode one, but a quick cursory check of IMDb tells me Daphne Dare is to blame. So Daphne Dare and Dougie Camfield.
I think I have to make my choice John Wiles. And, you know, we've been bashing on him a lot, so I'm not going to say everything. But I'm going to say, for John Wiles, my choice has to be his and, I suppose, Donald Tosh's creation of Dodo. Because it's so strange that they did have very definite ideas of what they wanted the series to be, but they just seemed to have cipher-like ideas for what they wanted the characters to be, and they were on a hiding to nothing.
And it's kind of lazy it's kind of lazy writing, because it's Biddy. It's Sue. She's pretty much on paper the original, before they all looked at it and said, that's too thin, we better build it up and put something interesting in there.
Yeah.
Biddy? What was she called? Yes.
Biddy. Yes. So, yeah, it's John Wiles for me, and I suppose it's just his sort of very broad strokes and not coming back to do the fine detail later approach to the show. And it borders on contempt. It's like,
I think there was a lot of contempt behind
the scenes. Why did he want the job? It's a bit like if you're buying a house and you want to renovate, you buy something that's roughly in the right shape to begin with. You don't, unless it's completely falling apart and shambolic, which Doctor Who wasn't, you don't buy the thing and then completely try and rip it down and put up something new.
Yeah, but wasn't he pushed into the role? His first love was writing, and he went back to writing after this. It was his first and only production role.
Mm.
Mm. Well, they turned him off the line.
Well, yeah, there was a lot of antagonism between those two and an ego thing, and he just didn't have the lightness of touch or charm to deal with someone like Billy, which I can imagine being your first production job would have been pretty hard shakes, because, you know, I don't think he put up with much. It was short shrift if you didn't agree with him.
Yeah.
We've been very sympathetic to him because he's...
Exactly.
He's our main character, but... Yeah, you know, there are two sides to everything, and he was clearly very difficult to work with, and we've certainly heard that from other people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Richard...
Again, this is the things where you could see what the series had started to do and how interesting it had set out to be anything and everything and very experimental, and I think Wiles actually managed that. I love Dalek Master Plan and some of the stories that followed after that, again, really uncompromising in what they were setting up for and how they just allowed them to be that. Both the Massacre and Master Plan sit really well together for those reasons. But I think we're actually getting into the state of we'll just do it because this is what you do. And that, I think, is more of Innes Lloyd, actually. And then his new
his new script editor, Jerry Davis. We're about to discover more of that. Yeah. Some more fun things to come up, both good and not so good. Yeah.
In terms of recommendations for this series, I would like to recommend a trilogy of Big Finish Companion Chronicles. And those are the ones featuring Peter Purvis as Stephen and Tom Allen as the new companion for the audio's Oliver Harper, who is a companion from Contemporary Earth with a secret, which I won't reveal because it becomes integral to the three stories. The first
Dodo
story
in disguise, back for revenge.
The first story is called The Perpetual Bond. The second story is called The Cold Equations. And the third story is called The First Wave. I shan't say too much about them, but very good performances from both leads. Of course, Peter Purvis, very good actor, and Tom Allen is a comedian, stand-up comedian. He is most famous for the radio series Bleak Expectations.
Which I listen to, and I love Bleak Expectations. It's hilarious.
It's sadly short-lived TV spin-off, The Bleak Old Shop of Stuff.
I didn't know they did that.
Yeah, it only ran for one season, and that's got lots of Doctor Who alum in it. It's got Anthony Stewart Head. Celia Imrie pops in for some of them. Both from Doctor Who. We own them. That is completely correct. Oh, we've just lost another Chumbly eye. Has anyone else got a recommendation?
Yes, I do. This is an unusual one because I've done, you know, sort of Doctor Who books and things before. But there is a sort of 6-minute video of Jackie Lane visiting Paris.
I've seen this.
In November of 2011. Now, I can't remember who authored it. But I will put a link to it in the show notes when this episode goes up. And it's delightful. It's done to the music of Edith Piaf. So it's Jackie Lane,
a.k.a. Dudley Simpson. You can actually play Running Through Paris, Running Through Paris in the background.
And it is it's really lovely. Charming. Jackie has, you know, never come back, although she did do the Doctor Who night thing for the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, she did a live cross or a pre-recorded message for the Doctor Who after party.
But she's never done a DVD commentary or a DVD extra. She's never participated in a Big Finish thing. You know, she's kind of walked away and you've got to respect that.
Well, she knows what the fans
have
also been saying over the years, which is unfair, I think.
But this is spectacular and lovely, and it will make you just love her again. So click on the link. You know, it'll be on the website and on the show notes on your podcast app.
We should do more little happy link things because it doesn't take much of your time away. Greg Miller put some terrific things up for the last episode. I'm almost willing to just segue to him for his choices. But if you're going to or wanting to put some extra time in from what you've heard of this season, I'd really recommend going back to my my pre-Votan loves of print media. Donald Cotton's books, we mentioned them during the podcasts, but his novelizations of both Mythmakers and Gunfighters are just fantastic and funny. And they're quick reads as well. There are audio versions if you prefer to listen to them, but it's just nice to sit up in bed for an hour before you go to bed, and you'll get through them in 3 or 4 nights. They're really good fun. Really good.
I have had the Stephen Thorne version on my phone for ages and ages. I just haven't had, you know, the time. But
okay.
I did follow your last recommendation. So
I enjoyed Crusade.
Yeah.
I have listened to The Mythmakers, and it's magical.
Excellent, isn't it? Yeah.
Right, well, I think that's about it from us. We will be back next month with another 3 podcasts where...
And some shiny things in colour.
Yes.
Oh, spoiler alert.
Yes, indeed. But as we end this season, I just would like to end this season with a little bit of verse that I came up with, if you don't mind, gentlemen. Because... there's something over Snowcap and it's not the moon. Next month, it's goodbye Hartnell and hello Troutoon.
Hey!
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good everything.
You've been listening to Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Tropes, 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 was recorded on Sunday the 10th of August. The next episode will be released on October the 12th. You can find us at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter.